previously on the Supporting Act podcast.
Now, tell me now, are you now or have you ever been a communist?
I just want to tell the truth.
You're weird.
Well then fuck all of you!
I'm gonna cry.
Let's get down and dirty.
And me with my dick out.
Oh my god, it's my daughter!
I'll set you on fire, Rob Schneider.
I would love to act in a musical.
Hey, this is life, whatever. La-di-da-di. I don't know, it's not working because I tried to download the download to my downloads and then I downloaded the download.
This is crazy, man. I can't believe it.
I saw things out of a Pasolini movie in real life, you know? It was like Sallow in a hotel room in Las Vegas.
The key to writing is to not do the first thing that pops into your head.
You should avoid watching people through windows.
I love the spiked bleach blonde hair. I wish I had spiked bleach blonde hair.
Everything makes me anxious.
I'm gonna shine a light on all this bullshit.
Yeah, I bet there's no dead bodies or drugs in here.
Why am I happy you're crying?
Do I look like I have a plan to you? I'm in a bathrobe and Crocs.
What the hell am I gonna do with the rest of my career? Nothing.
This week on a very special Supporting Act podcast.
Well, I guess this is just my life. I guess I'm just gonna keep on being awesome.
You're listening to episode number 24 of the Supporting Act podcast, in which I sit down with stand-up comedian Shane Moss. Shane and I have a lovely discussion about psychedelic drugs, the human brain, and doomed relationships. Stay tuned, you might learn something. All right, so you're listening to episode number 24 of the Supporting Act podcast. My name is Matt Moskal. I'll be your host. I'm a musician by trade, a journalist by education, and a motivational speaker for the deaf. If you're tuning in from iTunes, Liberated Syndication, Stitcher Radio, or showbizmonkeys.com, thank you so much for listening. If you're unfamiliar with the show, this is the program where we shine the light on musicians, comedians, artists just shy of the mainstream spotlight. And my guest this week is not shy of mainstream exposure at all. It's Wisconsin-born comedian. Before we get started, though, I would like to get some upcoming events and plugs out of the way. So Wednesday, May the 21st at 7 p.m., I will be appearing at the King's Head Pub and Eatery. I'll be hosting the Winnipeg Poetry Slam semifinals bout number 2 with feature reader Aaron Sim. Admission is $5 or $10 on a sliding scale. On Friday, May the 30th at 7:15 p.m., I will be hosting Folk in Word with performances by Mariachi Ghost, Hearing Trees, Micah Ehrenberg, as well as 6 of the city's finest slam poets. And this event will be only $12 in advance or $17 at the door at the West End Cultural Center. Friday, June the 6th, I will be performing as part of the Winnipeg Spoken Word Festival's Spoken Weird and Haiku Deathmatch Showcase. That's at the Gas Station Arts Center. Doors open at 7 p.m., $12 admission. And Saturday, June the 7th, at the Flying Bison Ranch in Matlock, Manitoba, I will be curating half an hour of stand-up comedy from 11:30 a.m. to noon. And from 12:15 p.m. to 1:30 p.m., I will be part of a songwriter's workshop with Richard Inman, Joe Madden, and Kieran West. Weekend passes for this event are $20 or $15 just for the day pass. I should probably let you guys know that I'm recording this introduction at about 1:15 in the morning. My schedule has been an absolute hydra. Anytime I try to chop its head off, it just seems to... But it has never felt so good to be so exhausted. And lately, I've got a lot of things lined up in the spoken word field. I'm doing as many comedy open mic nights as possible to get back in touch with my stage presence. And I'm playing a lot more gigs musically. People are paying me to talk now more during music gigs, which is a little weird for me. So things are looking good, to say the least. And I feel like I owe it a bit to this show for helping me reestablish that base and sort of get back in touch with what made me enjoy performing and being around creative types in the first place. And to thank you guys for listening, we're really bringing in some amazing guests over the next while. I hope you enjoyed John Wing. Mark Ford was an absolute treat to have on the show. I've got some really good feedback about that episode. I just found out we're going to have Mike Kaplan on a future episode of the show as well. And this week's episode is with another podcaster, which is amazing. He hosts a show called Double Date. His name is Shane Moss. He is a 5-time guest on Conan. That is to say, both Late Night with Conan O'Brien and Conan on TBS. And I'm going to play you a little clip of some of his stand-up comedy, actually, which was recorded on his latest Late Night appearance.
The longest job that I had before this, I worked for 4 years at a furniture factory in Wisconsin, where I'm from. I worked there with a bunch of Mexicans and a bunch of racists, so that was an interesting dynamic. Racist people, if you're white, they just tend to assume that you're just going to be on board with whatever horrible rants that they want to go on. It's very uncomfortable. So I'd be in the break room, just kind of hanging out, minding my own business, and all of a sudden some guy come barging in. Stan, Mexicans are taking all our jobs! Then in the next breath, he'd be like, and why don't they learn to speak the language? Why? Do you want them taking more of your jobs? You're a miserable, lazy bigot who nobody likes. English is the only thing you have going for you. Believe me. They're taking all our jobs. Well, that's quite convenient for me. Jobs are my least favorite thing about life.
That's a clip from my guest this week, Shane Moss, stand-up comedian. He was born in La Crosse, Wisconsin, and made his way up through the Boston comedy scene in 2004, and has since made countless late-night appearances. He co-hosts a podcast called Double Date. When I received word from Showbiz Monkey's webmaster, Paul Little, about Shane being available for a podcast interview, I proceeded to take my curiosity with his comedy a little further and examined more of Shane's career. Took some time to listen to his album, Jokes to Make My Parents Proud, which was released in 2010, and explored his various podcast appearances, of which there are many. And something became very abundantly clear very early on in this research, and that is Shane Moss is a very, very smart guy. And you can really hear it in his jokes, but you can definitely hear it in the conversations he has with others. And this was interesting for me because I kind of got to go back to my, you know, my university psychology classes and sort of dig up some little bits of knowledge and little fascinations I had about the human brain. And I don't know if I kept up, but I certainly had a great time with this conversation. So we do get into some intellectual matter, and Shane makes some absolutely amazing recommendations towards the end of the podcast. So do stick around to the end to check those out. But without further ado, this is my interview with stand-up comedian Shane Moss here on the Supporting Act podcast.
Basically, like, your brain's got a whole bunch of different modules all trying to, you know, get control and power you, and they're kind of battling it out over decision making and stuff and where to allocate resources. And you can knock out this one part of your brain that, that inhibits your artistic and creative abilities. That's why people with like some autistic people and stuff are like amazing artists. Yeah. So yeah, you can put this electromagnetic thing and you can zap this one part of your brain to paralyze it for a few minutes and draw like just awesome shit.
Is that
crazy?
Is there like a drug that can do that, do you think? Or
I don't. I almost just did I tried to do drugs last night.
Yeah.
I had someone gave me a DMT pill. Are you familiar with DMT?
Yeah, I'm, the God molecule, right? Or what is it called?
Spirit molecule.
That's the one, yeah, sorry.
Yeah, and, apology accepted. No, I can't forgive you for that. I'm sorry, that's just,
for not knowing my spiritual psychology.
Yeah, no one knows DMT. But, I'd smoked it a bunch of times, and I didn't know that it was that you could take it in a pill. And this girl's like, "Oh yeah, you can take it in a pill form." I was like, "Well, then bring me one of these pills, because smoking, it's amazing. And she said it was going to be like mushrooms. Well, I ate the fucking thing. Well, here I am like, oh God. I don't know. Do you ever trip? Do you ever?
I've tripped, yeah.
Well, I'm a bit of a veteran, but even still, every time before I like eat mushrooms or do anything, I'm like, oh, should I really do this? I don't know if this is a wise decision. Yeah. It always turns out great, but I get nervous. So here I am. I'm like, God, oh, I'm by myself. What if something happens to me? I'm like thinking all these like shitty thoughts. Meanwhile, I'm like taking an online neuroscience class about all the things that can go wrong in a brain so easily. I'm like, oh yeah. Boy, I might not be in the right mindset. And I took the thing and I'm like, okay, all right, I'm ready. I'm ready for whatever this thing has, to bring. And nothing happened. Just nothing happened. It was supposed to be like a 3-hour trip. And, I just had a disappointing evening in my shitty condo in Winnipeg.
It's kind of like a Gilligan's Island opening sequence of drug trips.
Yeah.
It's supposed to be a 3-hour tour, but. Yeah, you've always come across as very, like, high-functioning in interviews, like, very on a higher echelon of intellect in a lot of conversations.
Oh, boy, you just raised the bar way too much for my dumb brain.
Well, for example, one thing I've heard a lot in interviews, you said that you've willed yourself out of drinking alcohol, for example.
Yeah, well, I quit smoking. That's a bigger one. Really? That's like, I'll brag about that any day. Alcohol, it's just like, well, that's unfortunate that I had to come to that.
Yeah.
But, I quitting smoking was just like something just snapped in my head one day after 16 years of smoking. Someone asked me how long I've been smoking. I was like, like 11 years or so. And then I thought about it and I was like, no, 16 years. And then I was like, that's it. I'm never having another one. And then I just quit.
What about the number was so, like, alarming exactly?
That's a long time to smoke cigarettes. That's enough to, like, kill you right there. I was getting sick all the time. Oh, you know what it was? Was I was just, like, I had enough things that were just kind of going wrong in my life. And I was kind of questioning a lot of my own decision making. I was also like learning a lot about psychology at the time and just kind of questioning where my instincts came from and all of that sort of thing. And like just kind of what makes us who we are and like what defines us kind of as a person. And it was just a combination of things. And it's like, you know, smoking like is a part of who I am. I'm like, well, that's objectively just a bad thing. Like,
yeah.
No matter what my brain is telling me, no matter how bad I want a cigarette, it's just wrong. Whatever it's saying is absolutely wrong. And I just kind of thought about that a lot, with a lot of my decisions. So I've been able to gain a lot more self-control in my life by just kind of not trusting my brain and taking a second between before any of my impulses, but easier said than done.
Yeah. Well, I there's something in psychology I remember from university about this whole concept of like correlation does not equal causation. And that's something that happens a lot in the media is that people say, well, it just so happens that a lot of people who got lung cancer at this point in time are smokers, but that isn't necessarily data proving that smoking causes lung cancer. I'm not saying it doesn't, but I'm just saying that there are kind of loopholes and ways that the brain can, you know, maneuver itself around that.
Oh, yeah. Now, well, not only that, but you can always just like exercise a year ago, I started trying to exercise for the first time, which is like near fucking impossible. Our brains just aren't wired to be exercising. Like if a caveman saw us like running on a treadmill or something, be like, what the hell is going? And, like there was never a circumstance that our brain was wired for like, oh, I'm just going to burn a bunch of calories doing absolutely nothing, like running in place. That's a no-no for any species. We're just in a weird, particular time. I kind of forget where the fuck I was going with that.
The point.
What point was I making?
I don't know. I think the point I was trying to get to there as well was that
it's interesting.
Yeah, it's interesting that you would quit smoking, whereas like it feels like the more you delve into science, the more it's like, oh, I can justify this.
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, again, that's just that's where I was going. Your brain just makes up a million excuses for like, yeah. Oh, I'll quit tomorrow. Everything's tomorrow, you know, and so I try to. Like, think when I'm like, okay, what am I doing next? I think, what advice would I give to another person to do right now? Be like, you should exercise. And I'm like, fuck, I have to exercise. But not what I want to do.
Yeah. Were you ever an athlete? Like, did you ever do any? No.
No. And I'm still not. I'm still horribly uncoordinated and very self-conscious. Doing anything athletic. I'm pretty good at rock climbing now. I got into that about a year ago. But any other kind of like, I do CrossFit and I've been at that for like a year and I still feel pretty stupid most of the time that I'm there. And, I'm just like a weird, gangly, uncoordinated fella.
Is that something you do in like a gym, the CrossFit or?
If you're not familiar, it's a chain of like particular kind of gyms. It's always just like, they just get some weird empty space. It's very bare bones. It's just a lot of like dumbbells and squats and pull-ups and that sort of thing. There's no fancy equipment or anything like that. It's like a lot of like kind of military boot camp-ish. Style, and it's peer torture.
Well, that makes sense actually though. I mean, because, you know, working out and going to a gym, it's such an extraordinary set of circumstances. It's like, when else in my life would I ever run in a spot for, you know, an hour straight or something like that? So the idea of going through like military training in a gym or this whole, this caveman diet, for example, like these circumstances exist for a reason. People are being trained to fight and kill overseas, or people at one point in time had to forage for food. So your brain is kind of like, all right, well, if someone else can do it every day, I can, right?
Right. Yeah, I mean, for me, it helps. When I'm on the road and I try to exercise by myself, even if I have dumb DVDs that I've ordered and everything that are good workouts.
Yeah.
But, you know, you don't push yourself as much as when you're around other people. Again, it's just like a matter of kind of taking control away from yourself. And when you have the pressure from like someone else telling you what to do or being pressured by your peers and trying to like not be the last person running in and feeling embarrassed, that kind of just pushes you to, fight back against your brain going, what the hell are you doing to me right now? You idiot. But yeah.
So you're from, La Crosse, Wisconsin?
Yes, it's not a lot of people are familiar with it, but it's on the border of Minnesota and Iowa.
Yeah.
Big drinking city. We have the world's largest six pack.
I heard. Yeah. So,
you heard that?
Yeah.
Oh my God, you've really done your research. How did you hear that?
I've been on the La Crosse website, actually.
What?
Yeah, I've been looking up.
What? You've done more research for this interview than any person ever has. This is amazing.
I read an essay from one of the former police chiefs of La Crosse saying that in the 1980s, because you have that bit about racism and your Mexican coworkers from when you worked in a factory.
Oh, yeah.
So I was like, what? Where did he grow up that people were like that? So I look it up and there's an essay right there on the La Crosse website. It's like, in the 1980s, some Cubans came over as part of like President Carter's, refugee program. And all of these refugees basically came in. Some of them were actually political prisoners or criminals that snuck in like Trojan horse style. And those Cubans wrecked society.
Oh, that's the Hmongs.
Yeah.
They're not Cubans. They're, Laotian.
Okay.
It's a weird, no one else has them. It's a weird thing. They literally, like, a few of them came, I don't know what the circumstances were, but a few of them came to La Crosse, Wisconsin and Minneapolis, and then they just all started coming there, and they didn't wreck society in any way. They're like the you know, they're Asian. They're like good at math and that sort of shit. Like they all are.
They opened a family restaurant and their children ran.
Yeah. And, but you know, they are different. They were a novel skin color for the area. And yeah. So everyone's like, the whole neighborhood's falling apart. That is just the small town mentality.
I love that the chief of police is writing this on the website. He's like, and then they came and then violent and sexual crimes greatly increased. No data to prove it. Information there. Just saying like, and that's what it was like to be in the police force back then.
Those cops there suck so bad.
Really?
They're horrible, horrible people. Cause they don't really, there's not really any crime there.
No.
And they like to think that they're really doing something, and there's like so many police officers per capita there. And they really like to, I don't know if they're trying to convince themselves that their jobs are meaningful, but, they're pretty horrible. They harass a lot of people. Like, my parents don't like the police officers there, and they're like, my mom's like, oh my gosh, oh gee whiz, the idea of crime is the worst thing for, and even she's annoyed by the police officers there, so.
Really?
It's a weird, it's not as racist as it used to be, but it's still. Yeah. And I was outside of La Crosse when I had that factory job, so.
Okay, so that's a different environment, yeah.
Yeah.
But you kind of grew up with it. It was still kind of instilled in the...
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I used to be racist back when I was like really young. It was just everyone was is just like, you know, rubs off on you. And if you've never if you've never been around people and that's all that you hear about like minorities is that they're criminals and that sort of thing, then you're scared.
Well, like I grew up in a town of 10,000 people in southern Ontario, and a big part of that was like homophobia was so rampant because there were no gay people in my high school for a great period of time. And anyone that came out like in grade 12.
Right.
They're like, fuck you guys, I'm gay, I'm out. And then they'd leave.
Yeah.
And that was it. And it would be like, damn, how did we know? And, but I very quickly.
Sneaky, sneaky homos.
I very quickly kind of grew out of that because, you know, I'd go to the big city every weekend and, you know, you'd see everything and.
Yeah.
You know, I went to a gay bar once and tried to convince a guy to buy me a drink and he was like, nice try, honey. You're not on my gaydar.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I get drinks when I drank, I would get drinks. It made me feel pretty good about myself.
Yeah. It's good to have somebody on the other side of the glass taking a look, you know? You're kind of like, you can't really break through the glass, but you know, I'm glad that you like what you see. I'm glad that I'm appealing to you who seems to be very well put together.
Yeah, there's it's interesting just where we get our sense of like moral disgust and all of that sort of thing. There's a lot of interesting stuff. So kind of so morality is kind of like this higher functioning cognitive process that came along like much later on in our evolution after instincts and everything else. And so like it was kind of built on top of pre-existing things in the brain. So like my favorite study to illustrate this is, they take, this person comes in to take a survey. And so they come in and they get in this elevator and the study actually starts in the elevator. They don't know this, you know, but there's a Confederate in the, an actor in the elevator and he's got either a hot cup of coffee or an ice water or something cold. And he's got his hands full and he's like, oh, hey, can you hold on to this for me for this? To the subject, and you know the subject would be like, oh sure, takes the drink, holds on to it on the elevator ride up, here you go, gives it back to them, and then goes in, takes the survey, not thinking anything of that, and then at the end of the survey they're like, did you run into anyone like on the way up here? And they're like, oh yeah, there was one person, and they're like, can you describe that person? And and their description of that person will change depending on whether they were holding on to a cold or a hot drink. They'll be like, oh, that person was like a really warm, seemed like a really warm, friendly person. And, if it's cold, they're like, oh, they seem kind of like frigid, a little distant. And so the idea is that kind of, those higher functions of things, like our brain kind of creates metaphors on top of these pre-existing sensory instincts that we already had. So, what's a good example? You say, that disgusts me. And it's not like you eating something that tastes bad. Right. It's behavior. So it's the same sort of physical thing. So they do that same stuff with like cleaning products. Like they'll give someone a bunch of different options of like, so they'll have someone write, something about something they did as a kid, just any story you want. And then they have another group write a story of something that they're ashamed of doing when they were a kid. And then they offer them like three different gifts at the end. One of them's like a iTunes gift card. Another one's a fruit basket. Another one's a basket of fancy soaps and stuff. And people that wrote, the thing that they're ashamed of often, more often than not, will pick the basket of soap. More than the other people. And it's a way of like cleansing themselves, and they find people will lie more if you give them an opportunity to wash their hands before that happened. And so, you can actually, if you show people pictures of like, disgusting things like a turd or, you know, something like that, and then you have them rate their like political views, you can disgust people into becoming like more homophobic. Like people will become more homophobic the more, gross things that you show them. It's just like some crazy wiring.
That would explain it, because my small town constantly smelled like cow shit. So
there you go.
It's a farming community. Everything just stank at the high noon. You know, you'd go out for recess at school and it would be like, hide under something. It's coming, you know?
Yeah.
That actually makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, that could be. And it's just, also I think with a small town, it's just people's, just because people aren't exposed to as much,
yeah.
So probably their immune system isn't as prepared for foreign things, and people are just nervous about any outside world. Their kind of threshold for ambiguity is pretty low. So
yeah.
I think that's where racism, homophobia, not to defend those people, it helps to help explain it.
Yeah, well, it's kind of like with an elderly person when you're like, oh, they're too far gone. You can't change the way they look at things now. They're,
yeah, I know.
You know, they've thought this their whole life, and all of a sudden you're going to tell them to think a different way.
I know.
Sometimes you just have to explain the behavior and understand the behavior, not necessarily try to control it, but at least control your exposure to it, that kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
So long as it's not too harmful, I guess. I do want to say something, though, about the police department in La Crosse. I do want to get back to that really quickly.
Okay.
I just actually was reading online.
Did you find my police report or something?
I did
like
not
that.
Find your police report.
My police record.
No, and apparently in 2010, they were named the most secure place to live in the United States for small towns. So I guess they're...
Yeah, they have like the most police per cap. It's like a military Orwellian like city to live in. It's kind of terrifying.
That's like, that structure just doesn't make any sense to me. The most like bars per capita and then like the most police per capita.
Yeah,
it's like,
yeah.
What are you trying to... Do you
yeah, so it's like, it works out because there's enough, they get enough funding for the, keep all these police officers on staff from all of the alcoholics just doing dumb, silly shit and underage drinking and whatnot.
Yeah.
And then so during the day then there's all these extra police around with like nothing to do but harass people. So.
Kind of sounds like the small town from Hot Fuzz.
Yeah.
It's kind of got that vibe some to it. So you moved to Boston in 2003, started telling jokes out there in 2004, right?
Yep.
Now, what was the like comedy landscape like in Boston at that time?
It's hard to even look at it objectively, but I felt at the time it was so exciting because it was like, Boston had this very famous, they're part of this comedy boom in like the 80s when all these amazing comedians came out of there, but everyone at the same time was like doing like crazy amounts of cocaine, and there's all these epic stories of like amazing people that either caught a break or ruined their lives, And so it had been like a decade or so since that had all gone away. And so it needed like a spark, and it just happened to be set up right. There's enough rooms around. There's just plenty of stage time to be had, and some good rooms as well. And there were a few people that were starting to come up and get funny, and there were like enough good role models around, and then there are some veterans too that you could watch and learn from. And it was just a great nurturing environment. There's places like the Comedy Studio, which is this little hip venue across from Harvard Square that's just like seats like 70 to 90 people or something like that. It's a very small little place, and they would have all these showcase shows, and he would give new people spots here and there. And it's just always hot audiences, like everything would just kill, and they understood that it was a lot of new people, and it was just great for developing. So when I started, there was just a whole bunch of supportive comedians that got me a bunch of work right away. And it took me about 2 months to figure out how to deliver jokes, without like pissing myself. And then, after that, things kind of skyrocketed for me a little bit.
Now, you're doing some things, like, I saw your first, appearance on Conan O'Brien, and you were doing things with your jokes then that a lot of people would be even afraid to do at some open mic nights. Mm-hmm. For example, I'm referring to the bumper sticker.
Yeah, yeah.
Where the joke kind of falls flat, and then you turn around and you say, oh, I'm sorry, I meant put this on other people's comments.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, were you at all nervous doing that on television, just knowing that that kind of depended on a moment of silence, or?
No, I've been more nervous since that time. Like, I kind of, the road's kind of beaten that courage out of me, because there's so many variables and so many, and so little attention span some places, and so many things can go wrong. So, but I was, when I started, I was very good at like saying something that would completely alienate the audience. I had a lot of jokes like that.
Yeah.
And then the punchline would kind of flip it around and make it all okay. And it was a really good way to start a set, because the audience is already nervous when you walk out. They don't know if you're going to be funny, and they're nervous for you. They're nervous for themselves. Everyone's nervous. And so to build that tension up even more to like a breaking point where it's like, oh God, I need to stop feeling so uncomfortable, and then you give them that release. It just kind of gets it all out for people. My act is much, much different than that now. I don't do that nearly as much as I used to. It won me awards and things, that style, and got me a lot of TV spots and all of that kind of thing. But things just all happened really quick for me. So I was just like, well, I guess this is just my life. I guess I'm just going to keep on being awesome until I caught the breaks and everything.
Yeah.
And then you reach a point and things kind of taper off and start to plateau. And then you're like, oh shit, I need to like work and develop as a comedian and start trying new things.
Well, it's like that hot air balloon story from years ago with that kid. They're like, oh, he's in the balloon. Someone's gotta get him down from there. And then it turns out the kid was just hiding in the house, and the kid said, oh, we were doing this for a TV show. We were doing this because we wanted to be on a show. And, you know, it's like you get to a point where you've gotten so much attention. And then people are like, oh, look over there. There's something else interesting going on. And you're like, no, hey, I'm still, I need to develop something new. And sometimes you win.
I was just a little kid with a hot air balloon. That's what I was. I get it. I get the metaphor completely.
I'm not trying to belittle your career.
I was just a dumb kid with a hot air balloon. That's exactly what my life was like. It worked out well for a long time.
Yeah. But the awards have to feel nice. I mean, I'm sure in your experience, other things probably like would be a little more valuable than an award in a sense, like having something personal, like being able to tell a certain part of your life or a certain point of
your person. Like finding meaning in life.
Yeah, exactly.
Or happiness.
That's what we call wisdom.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, the awards have to feel good, but I was talking to a comedian from Toronto named Mark Forward about this, and the idea is that, you know, you win the award, do you accept it as praise to keep doing what you're doing, or do you look at it as, all right, that's going to look really nice on my fireplace when I move out of my bachelor apartment and I get a fireplace, but otherwise I have to keep challenging myself to do this in the ways that make me happy.
You know? Oh, yeah, yeah, you definitely have to keep challenging yourself. I mean, I went through a huge change like a few years ago where I was just unhappy with everything that I was doing and kind of scrapped everything and started fresh and changed my look and my behavior and my life and my act and my style and everything else. And it was rough for a while. It was like I was starting all over again. But in front of paying customers. Yeah. Whereas when I started the first time, it was like in a no lose open mic kind of situation.
Yeah.
When I started all over again, it was in front of people that were expecting a lot.
It's like Andy Kaufman. I remember watching the movie Man in the Moon, and there's all those scenes where he's out at comedy clubs and he's like, do you want to come up here and touch my growth or whatever? And, and things like that. And I can't help but look at the audience and go, these people paid to see him. This is insulting.
Yeah. 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 I know it is. It's sometimes that stuff is like, it's so epic to like hear about. Yeah. Afterwards, but you don't want to be the audience.
No.
There.
You don't want the experiment happening in front of you.
No.
Unless it's like maybe like Tig Notaro with the cancer situation. I mean, that crowd sounded like they got something that no one else in the world will ever experience again, or.
Yeah, yeah, you know, there's a lot of those magic moments. That's part of what makes live comedy, special. And, because I think a lot of times, I mean, it's so many people when I do a show, you know, it might be different at like more alternative venue or something like that, that gets more, a little more comedy savvy people or a little more people that are just into going out and catching more live shows. But a lot of times when I'm in clubs, it's maybe people that go out once a year for some sort of live entertainment thing. You know, that's a lot of people and they're busy with life and kids and all that. And this might be their first comedy show ever. And like, they were probably drugged there by people and probably like, I've seen live comedy on TV. I've seen, you know, the 5 minutes on late night and it's funny, but you know,
yeah,
I don't care. But when they go and see it live, I mean, people are really blown away. It's just a totally different thing. And it's just that unpredictability of it and also being part of the audience and everything. But yeah. Live comedy. Hooray.
It's the most difficult art form I've ever encountered to do on stage, simply because, I made a joke about this on Twitter yesterday. If you're a musician, someone offers you 5 more minutes, you're like, oh, okay, I'll play a cover, I'll do another song. Or if you're, you know, if you're a dancer or whatever and you get 5 more minutes to dance, I'm sure you've got some moves or something. But in comedy, it's like someone gives you 5 more minutes and sometimes you're like, I could maybe ad-lib something, but I have nowhere else to go.
Yeah. The other thing is, I mean, a lot of people say this, it's just with music, you don't need people to necessarily pay attention. That's nice and everything.
It is,
but it's not
nice,
going
yeah.
to like wreck your life if people are having a little side conversation while you're playing your music. You know, a lot of times that's what musicians are, just in the background or something like that. You would never hire a comedian to be at like Sunday brunch to just be in the background, you know, so, you know, people can tune in when they want to or whatever, you know.
Yeah,
comedy just doesn't work that way. So I don't know, it's kind of a high pressure situation in the moment, I guess.
Now, you've been podcasting for a while now, the double date.
Yeah, yeah. It's, my girlfriend and I, she's a funny comedian as well, April Macy, and we have, it's her and I and another couple each week. We have a lot of comedian couples on, and then we have, just friends of ours and our wacky neighbors and stuff like that.
Is it ever more entertaining to have somebody that isn't a comedian sort of in the discussion? Or?
Yeah. I mean, we've had some really awkward episodes where it's just like the other couple was just like too nervous or whatever, and it was their first time, and they were just kind of not handling it well. Which is interesting. You know, you don't get, most podcasts wouldn't ever have like, here's just a random person on, you know?
Yeah.
But just because of the structure of the show, that's how it works out. And, but a lot of times there's people that, like, we had a couple on recently. They were both really funny, but, the comedian's girlfriend, who wasn't a comedian, I thought was way funnier on the podcast. And she had never done anything before. You know, and it's just, I mean, the idea is it's meant to be a double date, just a little more pressure to be funny or interesting or whatever.
I'm always fascinated by the partners of comedians. Like like for example, I use this all the time, like Tom Waits and his wife Kathleen. Obviously Tom Waits is not a comedian. He's a very funny guy, but he and his wife write all of his songs together, and she knows exactly how to write in his voice and how to write things that would make for interesting music for him to release. And in a lot of relationships, a lot of comedians, like I just recently heard an interview with Jim Gaffigan where he talked about, you know, his wife is his sort of sounding board for all of his jokes. And that happens, I think, a lot in comedy is, first of all, you have to find somebody that's willing to listen to you.
Willing to be a sounding board. Oh, my God. It sounds so nice at first.
Yeah.
Girls are like, oh, my God, you must just laugh all the time. Isn't that great? Oh, my God. And I've told every new girlfriend that I've been with, I mean, I've only had long relationships, but I'm like, listen, you enjoy this now because I don't stop. Like, I don't stop writing jokes and wanting to work it out. And like, that's what I do. And eventually you're going to really get, they're like, oh no, I could never get sick of hearing, you know, that's what falling in love does to you.
Yeah.
Oh, you're perfect in every way.
I can't even do that anymore. It's something, I think it's something Louis said, but it's like every new relationship is just a countdown to disappointment or something.
Oh yeah, it really is.
So whenever I'm with someone new or whenever something new and fancy comes into my life, I'm like, it's just a matter of time.
Oh yeah. I mean, it depends on what you're after, but I mean, as far as I'm concerned, falling in love is better than being in love. I mean, if you're looking to have a family, than being like finding someone that's like stable and like is a partner and we're a team.
Yeah.
Like that's a different thing than that falling in love, crazy romantic adventure. That's a very different thing. And definitely more, I'm starting to realize more probably my lifestyle, I think, eventually. What I'm saying is it's probably not going to work. So is what I'm saying, but which we often talk about on our podcast, which is weird and interesting. How we often just talk about how much we are in love, but we're probably probably just not going to work out.
But accepting that and working through that, like having that conversation, I mean,
I think that my friend, hilarious comedian, And amazing rapper. And usually I would not go throwing that around lightly. Like, you should check out this comedy rap thing. I'm usually not a fan, but my friend Zach Sherwin, I wrote a song about, and I mean, I think about the same sort of thing a lot, but it's like, it's basically his idea for a dating site that's all just people that are going to be moving soon.
Yeah.
Like, so you're here in Winnipeg and you're going to be moving in 9 months or something.
Yeah.
So you find other people that are in Winnipeg that are also going to be moving or are cool with the fact that you're going to be moving. So you can have a fun little 6 month relationship and then that is it. There's an expiration date on that sucker. No hard feelings. This is what it was all about. That was a lot of fun. Handshake, see you later. But, you know, it's easier said than done. That's, yeah. We have a lot of, there's a lot of mechanisms going around there that are hard to, trump. That's, I think about that so much about just that, because, I'm kind of writing about this in my new act about how, it's like it's, you know, established, I like study a lot of like sciencey things and decision making and all that kind of stuff. And it's very good for getting you out of a rut. Like I can think, well, you know, depression is kind of this adaptation for making you kind of stop and evaluate your strategy and see if you need to figure out a different strategy for a particular thing. And, you know, sometimes you don't need to. It's just your brain being like, hey, let's check in for a minute. Let's slow down. Let's think things out. And it feels horrible. So you don't like, you don't think to yourself, oh, this is maybe a good thing for me to slow down. But, so it's good for rationalizing things. But when it comes to something good, like sex and like drugs and like pleasurable things, like really the pleasure circuits in our brain are really just like a trick. They're really just like they're like, basically the carrot that evolution uses to get you into doing its bidding. Like, we shouldn't be having sex or anything. Like, it's a weird thing to do. Like, if you look at any animals, like risking, they have mating season and it's like, everything's normal. And then there's mating season and they're like all killing each other and like everything just, I just spit all over everything.
That's
Sorry.
Okay. I do that all the time.
And,
I have what they call a lisp. So it's,
you do?
It's very minor. Yeah.
I didn't notice your lisp. Well, you don't anymore. yeah, I wouldn't even bring it up. I wouldn't, now I'm just going to hear a lisp for the rest of the time. But yeah, so that's a little bit of a bummer.
Yeah, well, the thing that, I remember this, like, I don't know where I read this, but some great advice I was given was don't masturbate where you study. Because if at any point in time you reward yourself for even the slightest bit of hard work, you're not gonna wanna keep studying.
Right, right, right.
Because it's just kinda like, well, we'll call it a day, I'll light a smoke and fall asleep and everything's good.
That oh, yeah. Yeah, that happens all the time. And just about like, I mean, a lot of like what's pleasurable is good for our genes, not good for like an individual person. Yeah. Like, so your body wants you to have a bunch of sex.
Yeah.
Always so you'll sex. Have, but if you had, yeah, but if you had like 30 kids, you know, if there's no contraception or whatever, and now you're like left to care for 30 children, that would be horribly tasking on you as a person, and you'd probably die an early death, you know.
Just from all the stress.
Just from all the stress of 30 kids running around. But anyhow, I don't know. I don't know where I was going with that. I guess I'm just like down on I've been thinking about long-term relationships recently and just like how they can be somewhat impossible sometimes despite both parties' best intentions.
I think it's the most painful thing in a relationship when you're depressed and you're looking inward and you're working on yourself, because that's what depression is kind of, you were saying it before, it's your body going, I don't want to deal with any of this. I need to deal with this right now because this is a little broken. This needs a little bit of a spit shine. Whereas all of this.
All the outside.
Yeah. I can't protect or save any of you right now because I'm pretty sure I don't know how much longer I might have left.
I know. I'm barely holding on myself.
Exactly. And the thing is when you're in a relationship, sometimes the person you're with can tend to be like, you know, you're never telling me about what's wrong. You're never letting me in on what's going on there, you know, and it sounds like something very serious, but you're going, yeah, it's called I'm depressed and it's fine. I'm working through it. You don't have to concern yourself with I understand and I appreciate it, but.
Yeah. And it's just like, you know, why wear another person down?
Yeah, exactly.
With your problems, but I don't know. I guess it's maybe just a guy thing, not to, you know, people hate talking about gender roles, but, we are wired a bit differently and girls just seem to just be much more comfortable just like calling up all the, hey, here's all of my problems in life and let's talk them all out. And which is probably healthy for them, or they wouldn't be doing it that way. But guys usually just like internalizing, things. I like burying that shit until it hopefully goes away.
Yeah.
Or one day I murder a bunch of people.
But I don't even think that murder even comes from like from that sort of place. I think
that was a joke. I'm not going.
Oh, I know. I'm fascinated by. I'm not fascinated by like serial killers. They they don't excite me because everyone's like, he was a quiet man. He kept to himself a lot. You know, I wouldn't be surprised to find out like Rob Ford, the mayor of Toronto, is a serial killer. He's got sort of a John Wayne Gacy thing going.
Yeah, yeah.
But I mean, I can't get too caught up in the personalities or those sorts of things. I'm more so one of those people that was always grown, like instilled this belief, you're going to get kidnapped by someone that you care about, was like something they told you at one point in time, you know?
Right.
All these kidnappings are people that they know and.
Yeah, that is. I remember, I think about that a lot sometimes, weird enough. I think about my parents being like, and now that I look back, it'd be like, if I had an aunt or an uncle like tickling me a bunch or something when I was a little kid. And then sometime later, my parents being like, now there's good touch and there's bad touch. Like, Jesus Christ, were you really looking at, like, now looking back, like, you were looking at your own brother.
Yeah.
Being like, boy, I hope they don't molest my son just because he is, like, trying to entertain me. Because he doesn't, what do you do with a 4-year-old?
Yeah, what do you want?
Have this fucking conversation with a 4-year-old about existentialism? No, you fucking tickle him. We live in such a fucking weird society where the news just shows the extremes of life. It's like, here's 4 murders, a child rape, and someone won the lottery. Like, all these things that are so far outside of what reality actually is, which is just like, if the news was anything like reality, it'd just be like, here's Shane on the couch trying to get up from, and do insanity in a shitty condo in Winnipeg, and he's getting up. Nah, he's back down. Like, that's what happens in a day of like your average person. You drive to work and you get there, and like, there's not some massive pile up and fires and explosions and all. That's not what reality is. But, our brain just loves to latch on to those extremes, especially the tragedies and stuff, and this Malaysian airplane that we still keep hearing about. It's like, I think it's about 3,000, close to 3,000 people a day die of heart disease in the U.S., which is like, and people here, it's like, most of your listeners just fell asleep hearing that statistic.
Yeah.
Like, you hear, cause your brain doesn't even know what to do with it. Cause it's like, oh, heart disease, it's just this thing that happens.
Over here,
and it's just like it's such a big number of people. And it's like, you can't really see it. You can't really envision it. Like a plane going down in the ocean. Oh my God, that could happen to me. No, it's not going to happen to you. You need diet and exercise, not like being scared of spiders and airplanes. Like,
well, I've done sales jobs, for example. Like, I've sold like modems and internet to people at work, and one statistic we're given is 90% of the bandwidth is used by 5% of the users.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to try to do a bit on stage about, I'm not afraid of dying in a plane crash, but I am afraid that I am the center of the universe. And it's this idea that we, in our own mind, we don't rationalize this idea that we're part of that 95%. We want to be that 5%. We're like, I probably am that 5%, or I must be that 5% because I'm a little bit weird, or I'm a little bit abnormal. No, you're quite plain and you're quite ordinary, and you know.
Yeah, I wish there was like, I wish just more people would just start talking like this. It's just like so. I don't understand what the taboo is with like being like, hey, life's rather boring sometimes, isn't it? Like, maybe it's not all just, like, explosions and stuff like that. It's just kind of mundane most of the time. And that's why you don't, like, remember those. That's why days pass by so fast, because there's nothing really to hold on to, because nothing eventful happened. Unless there's, like, a terrorism, and then you have another reason to hate brown people or something like that.
I always knew they were up to no good.
Yeah.
I love that whenever something bad happens and someone says it, like, I always knew they were up to
it. I told you.
That person that just had, like, this nondescript, just, like, this completely out of the blue, like, prejudice, and then they get to be the one that's like, I was right all along, and
I know.
Fuck all you, now I'm gonna be the leader of the New World Order. And it's like, thank you very much, Garbage Man, but that's no need necessary for that, you know.
I know. Hey, but if instead of, that's, because that's what people are talking about around water coolers. It's like the kidnapping that happened, or, you know, some complete bullshit. There should instead, I had to go to AA, not when I quit drinking years ago. I was at, like, court ordered to go to AA, and I just went, you know, just because the court made me, and I hated it, and it would have never helped me quit drinking and everything. If it helps the listener, great. Do what works for you, but.
Yeah.
I thought it was stupid. And, but the one thing about it was, like, all of these people are, like, sharing, like, shitty things about feeling down and all that. And then realizing that that's just like, oh, they're not unique. Like, everyone kind of goes through these things and has dark thoughts and stuff. Like, why do you have to be a drug addict in, like, hiding in a fucking church basement? And it's anonymous, and no one must ever share this. To, like, just talk about, like, hey, I had a bad day yesterday. Like, we just need, like, a sad club or something like that.
I completely agree. Well, that's the whole, like, the opening bit of Fight Club. He's just going around to all these different support groups trying to feel something. And that's kind of, that's how we deal with it. There's such a faux pas or a taboo around it. And I think that has been breeding bad behavior. Like, I really think that, I know that quitting drinking is a noble thing to do, if, you know, for your wallet, for your well-being to a degree.
Yeah. You know, I mean, first off, I tried to get it under, if I could just drink like a normal person, that'd be great. Like, I just think it's unfortunate that just, the way that I drink plus the career that I'm in just didn't work out for me, but I don't have anything
nothing.
I say no one should ever smoke a cigarette again in their life. But as far as alcohol, it's like, if you do it right, it's, you know, can be good.
As we wind down the show, I like to dedicate usually the last little bit of the program to talking about, basically, if you have recommendations, like people who have heard us drop tons of names throughout the show, you know, if you're to direct any listener to any other comedian or a musician, or, you know, maybe a famous psychologist or something, someone that people could look up and learn more from or be educated by.
Well, I like, depends on what you're into. So, first off, I guess I already mentioned Zach Sherwin. You should check him out. He's got, a lot of really awesome, interesting, funny comedy raps, and people may know, Rap Battles of History.
Yeah.
Is a channel that, you know, each episode gets like 40 million views or something. They're quite popular. He's done several of those.
Okay.
And, so yeah, he's very talented, funny guy. And, let's see, as far as books or things to check out, there's a guy, V.S. Ramachandran, who, does a lot of interesting, he's like kind of one of the top neuroscience authors. He has a book called A Telltale Mind, which kind of explains how the brain works by taking case studies of people that have had strokes, and so there's one tiny little part of their brain that shuts off or malfunctions, and then how their behavior changes without that, and that's how it kind of illustrates, like, what part of the brain controls what.
Yeah.
And it's super interesting, and these case studies are, like, absolutely unreal. And it's like people that think their parents are, like, zombie actors and stuff because they had this weird stroke and this, but they're normal in every other way, and like why that happens. And And then as far as, let's see, who else? I think Steven Pinker does a lot of, good evolutionary psychology stuff. He's like kind of a big name. I think he's not, as much of a prick as Dawkins. who can be fucking annoying sometimes, no matter how right he is about everything all of the time.
It's one thing to be right. It's another thing to be humble while you're doing it. Right?
Yeah. He is a horrible, horrible prick sometimes. But,
have you ever had an interaction with him or?
No, I haven't. I mean, I would love to meet him. I think he's brilliant. I just wish that he, like, I liked Hitchens more for, like, if I'm going to hear someone call other people stupid, yeah, I'd rather hear Hitchens do it in, like, an awesome, playful, like, roasty kind of a way.
Yeah.
Rather than, Dawkins just, like, I'm better than everyone kind of a way. But.
Yeah, the roast isn't always about bullying people so much as it's about sort of, you know, being able to joke about somebody's personality in a way that they're kind of both comfortable with and also is kind of exploitive of their personality as well.
Right. I mean, Hitchens would have been a great comedian.
So many of the psychologists would. So many, also philosophers as well. Yeah. There's a good book series that's, I think it's like Plato and a platypus walk into a bar, and it uses philosophy to describe different styles of humor and why certain jokes work really well. And, you know, they take a lot of like Stephen Wright material and kind of dissect it. There's a couple of them in there. They're very entertaining.
Oh, that's interesting. My friend is a professor at the University of Colorado Boulder. He wrote a book with a journalist called The Humor Code.
Okay.
It's out, it's in bookstores now, and it's all about the science of comedy and kind of what he does very well is he explains very, very well the science of like what makes something funny on paper.
Right.
There's so many variables with like performance and delivery and stuff that he doesn't really, like, he knows it's just a little too complicated to cover in a book. But it's really, really, interesting if you want to, kind of learn how jokes work and why things are funny. I think it would probably help people be a funnier person too and realize when also they're being too inappropriate, you know, at work or something and it's not the right time.
That's the one that,
But yeah, The Humor Code by, my friend Peter McGraw.
I could do hours of, podcasting about when a joke isn't going too far, you're just taking things too far and not being funny.
Yeah.
That's really common at open mics these days that I've been to. And it's just like,
I don't know
who you're trying to emulate, but
I just started bringing this joke back recently of mine, and it's about people being offended by material and how they shouldn't be. And I tell an offensive joke and then I explain why, and I do a joke about how offensive that joke is, and it does really well. Right. But I forgot what happens when I tell that joke. Cause I just it hasn't had a place in my act for the last couple of years. And I forgot that people always come up to me afterwards now thinking, oh, this guy likes really offensive jokes, I bet. And the rest of my act isn't like that at all.
Yeah.
And then they just think, and this isn't like comedians telling like a really clever joke about 9/11 or the Holocaust or something. This is, that is done in a way that is, you know, they found a way to make it not as bad. I have people coming up to me recently here in Winnipeg. I started telling this joke again, and I've heard lots of horrifying racist jokes since I've been here. Just people that come up afterwards. I have one for you. Damn it.
I gotta commend those people for building up the confidence to do that. It's like, hey, good for you. You told a joke to a comedian, but at the same time, it's like, maybe keep some of those things a little further away from the public eye. Maybe don't whip it out in public like that.
Yeah. And it's like, why would we want to hear an internet joke that you, You know, sometimes when I travel to like Europe and stuff like that, people will be like, oh, when you were talking about this, I thought of that. Or that happens in other places too, but people are like, someone came up the other night when I did a show. I have a show about, or a bit about getting a text message from a wrong number.
Yeah.
And someone came up to me and had a funny story about getting a dick pic from a wrong number. That's an enjoyable, that's what I want. Something that was like relevant to my act, or something that is your own. I don't want to hear some dumb racist knock knock joke that you read off the internet. That's horrifying.
The guy who told you about getting the dick pic from the wrong number, did he have curly hair and glasses?
No, it was a lady.
Oh, never mind. There's a local comic who has a bit about that. He talks about, he's like, I don't know who Cheryl is, but I keep getting all, like, she's been giving her number to other guys. I mean, my number to other guys in order to throw them off. And I've been getting all of her, like, her text messages and her dick pics.
That's really funny.
Yeah.
So this lady just has a fake number memorized.
Yeah. And she just
for her, and it happens to be the comedian's number.
Yeah. It's a pretty good bit.
That's funny.
But yeah. Thank you so much for doing the show. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for having me.
No problem.
It's nice to meet you. I know what you've been through, 'cause I have been there too. Tell me your secrets. I promise to keep them. I won't hold it to you.
There you have it, folks. My interview with Mr. Shane Moss, stand-up comedian and host of Double Date Podcast. You can find that wherever fine podcasts are found. And you can find Shane Moss at Shane Comedy on Twitter. You can also follow me at Mr. Matt Moskal on Twitter. You can subscribe to our channel on iTunes, Stitcher Radio. You can also subscribe to our Tumblr or our various other forms of social media. They're everywhere. And give us some stars, maybe leave some comments. Please keep it polite enough. You know, I know my own faults. I know my weaknesses. I know what I'm doing. And yeah, so don't feel the need to remind me. But thank you so much for tuning in. Next week's show, I'm chatting with Mr. Kieran West of Kieran West and his Buffalo Band, a Manitoba musician who is putting out an album in just a couple weeks from now. So hopefully we can have a blast, he and I, as we're doing a songwriting workshop together on June the 7th at 12:30 in the afternoon, if I'm not mistaken. Now, it's about 1:45 here now, and I am about ready to hit the hay, as I have a long day ahead of me, but I would like to say thank you so much for tuning in. The cat is circling me the way a buzzard would circle, a corpse, sorry, a dying animal, I suppose, which is suggesting to me that, I need to go and wrap myself up with something very, very warm. But it was worth a try getting everything done, wasn't it? We've had a good time, haven't we? Anywho, thank you so much for listening. My name's Matt Moskal on behalf of the Supporting Act Podcast, saying thank you for listening, and remember that everybody opens for somebody sometime. Have a good night.